In this episode of Warwick Econ Sounds, we're meeting Dr. Aaron Advani, Assistant Professor of Economics and Impact Director of the Cage Research Centre. We'll be speaking with Aaron about his involvement with the Discover Economics campaign, the benefits of economic thinking, what pirate ships can tell us about effective organisational structure, how we've been measuring inequality wrong, his top tips for getting research in front of policymakers, and why economists shouldn't work alone. Dr. Advani, thank you very much for joining us for the Econ Sounds podcast. To start with, can you tell us a bit about Discover Economics? What's the campaign all about and why is it important?
Yeah, so the Discover Economics campaign has kind of two goals in mind. So the first is, if you look around at the current set of people who are economists, we're not collectively a very diverse bunch. And that's true kind of whether you look at people who are currently kind of leading the field, either as academics or in a policy space or kind of working in private companies. It's also true even when you look at our undergraduates, gender breakdown, ethnicity, whether you look at the proportion of people coming from a private school versus state school background. And so noting that it doesn't look like things are naturally diversifying as time goes on, we thought that one thing we ought to do was to try to kind of do something very active to try to change that. And so we spent some time talking to students from various backgrounds, school students from various backgrounds, to try to understand a bit about what the barriers were. And that leads us to kind of the second goal for Discover, which is we discovered that people have, unsurprisingly in a sense, different ideas about what economics is really about. Because economics is not on school curricula, it means that students don't tend to have a good idea of what economics is about. And they think of it somehow relating to finance and money. Some of them will tell you it's about inflation, but they don't really know what inflation is, but they know that's a relevant word. And they don't really have a sense that actually what we are is an applied social science, trying to understand the world using data and quantitative methods, but to really think about all of the kind of problems and issues that affect people's lives. And so I think the point of the campaign is, firstly, if we'd be a success if we could firstly kind of get people to understand what economics is really about so they can have a better sense of how to engage with it and what kinds of things we're doing. And then I think because of the fact that currently economics isn't available to students from most schools, they don't have a sense for what they could do with it, and therefore aren't currently going on to university to go and study it. And so I think if we could, as a second step, try to diversify the set of students who have heard about it and therefore can go on to study it at university, that would be the other goal we'd have.
So you're finding in a way that people have a stereotype idea of what economics is all about. Is it also a challenge that people think it's just, you know, endless maths, and that's something that perhaps puts off certain kinds of students? Or is it really just more about not knowing what it is that economists actually do?
Yeah, so I think one of the difficulties, again, with the way that economics probably in practice is taught in a fairly mathematical way. And the maths and the numbers do help and are useful in various kinds of ways. But a lot of the kind of what we do can be done without the maths. And you can understand a lot of the key issues without seeing any maths at all. And so I think there's a bit of a risk that because a lot of people who are economists now are very good at maths and understand how to do things mathematically. And because mathematical thinking does help at certain points, it can sometimes be over-mathematized. And it doesn't get across to people that really what the kinds of questions we're thinking about are much broader than basically kind of applied maths. And actually, a lot of the thinking and the process that you need to do to answer those questions can be done without any kind of very heavy maths. If you want to go quite clearly onto kind of further research as an academic, you probably do need some of those more advanced levels of maths. But you can certainly do an undergraduate without being able to do kind of extremely complicated mathematics. And you would still understand all of the details of kind of really what economics is fundamentally about and what the key issues are. But it does depend a bit also what you want to go on to do. If you go on to a fairly quantitative job, which a lot of economic students do, but not that all future students ought to, but if you're going on to quite a quantitative job, that math training can hold you in good stead. But the way of thinking that economics kind of provides is useful more broadly and without the mathematics.
Mm-hmm. And what is that way of thinking? What's that unique sort of approach to problem solving that you think economists have?
I mean, I guess fundamentally economics sees that individuals and other kind of what we think of as economic agents, so that can sometimes be companies, but really fundamentally individuals, are making decisions where they're making trade-offs. They're seeing the costs and benefits of decisions they make, and they're making those in kind of a marginal way. So they're thinking, given the state of the world that I'm in, given what's currently going on, what are the additional things I want to do, spend slightly more time on or slightly less time on? We always think about money, so obviously slightly more money on this, slightly less money on that, but also the way we choose to spend our time, the way we choose to spend our attention. There's a recent behavioral kind of theme in economics trying to understand, actually, given that we have limited attention spans, how do people choose to allocate their attention to different kinds of things? And that kind of then feeds through, even when you go into, you know, that sounds sort of nice and niche and feels like how we think about our own world when we're trying to decide whether to watch a bit more TV or should we try and spend a bit more focus on some kind of essay that I have to write, or in my case, an academic paper. But it also kind of feeds through even when you go, for a student, if you're going on to work, at some point, if you become the CEO of some organization, you have to think of how to allocate your attention between all the different business units in your company or all the different competing interests. And so these are real practical problems of, you know, resource allocation is fundamentally a kind of a key part, or is a kind of an abstract way of thinking about what we're doing as we're trying to decide how to make these decisions. And I think the economics helps you try to understand how you can get towards what seems like a better solution from where, what might start as a fairly arbitrary place to be. Thinking about how you can, and the other thing I think that economics really gets across is it's really fundamentally about information. People have this idea that economists care a lot about markets. And the sense in which we care about markets is that we think of markets as a good way of solving really what is fundamentally an information aggregation problem. So in a world in which I knew what everyone's preferences were, you know, if you become an undergraduate economist and you spend some time kind of constructing supply and demand curves, what you do is say, well, let's take a whole load of people and let's figure out what their utility function looks like. That is to say, what their preferences are. And let's add up all of those preferences to understand at a given price how many apples would each of them buy. Then we'll look at all of the sellers and say, okay, yeah, at a given price, how many apples would they like to sell? And then we kind of draw a supplier curve and a demand curve and say, okay, well, this is where the two things meet. And so what you could do if you were the government is to kind of add all those things up and say, okay, now I know what the price should be. I'm just going to set that price. Now, the thing is, you've had to go and figure out, well, for all of the suppliers and all of the potential purchasers, what are their preferences? What do they look like? And assume they can even write them down and describe them to you in some way. And then having done all that, you've added all that stuff up to find that price. That's obviously a very complicated information problem, even for a single market. And clearly, there are many markets, many goods, many things that interact with each other. Because actually, when I think about how many apples I want to buy, I'm actually thinking, how many of this kind of apple do I want to buy compared to that kind of apple, depending on what the relative prices of them are. So it's a very complicated thing for someone to kind of centrally plan. But the joy of the sort of the market is that you don't have to plan it. You can allow people to make their own individual choices and to think about what how they want to make these trade-offs. And information is aggregated by the price mechanism so that you can see what it is that people prefer. And if there's something that people want a lot of, price, relatively speaking, goes up. And that means that suppliers should, if they can, try and provide it more of it if it's profitable for them. And of course, that's not to say the markets are perfect. I should just, you know, obvious caveat, there are externalities, that is to say, there are things that the market won't price effectively. So the obvious thing is carbon, for example, in the current environment is something we care a lot about. Another thing in the actually very current environment of coronavirus is a natural externality is when I want to go out and, you know, whatever, sit on the beach, I'm creating an exclusion zone around me of, you know, 2 meters all around that no one else ought to sit in because they might breathe near me, and that's kind of a risk at the moment. And so I might not take that into account when I'm doing that. If you're in my drive to the beach, I'm taking up space on the road, and that's creating congestion for other people. You know, you're not in traffic, you are traffic. And so people don't take into account all of these externalities they have. And so one potential solution to some of those things is to think about pricing them. In some cases, pricing them is too complicated. It's actually just too difficult a problem. So it'd be too difficult to say, well, how much does everyone value sitting in a particular place on the beach? Probably in practice. So instead, what we do is say there's just a regulation that says you can't go to the beach right now, for example. I'm not quite sure what the current regulation is because it changes every week. And by the time you hear this, it will be anything else. But fundamentally, there are these kinds of issues. So one certainly is externalities, another is market power. So an example of market power is that there's only a small number of supermarkets. You know, in my area, there are 2 supermarkets nearby. And so when I have only those 2 competing against each other, they know that if their prices go up, it's not like there's space for a third supermarket just to pop up and say, oh, I can undercut those other 2 and I can charge at a lower price. And so another reason that the market might fail is that they have the power to be able to increase prices beyond what it costs them to produce something because they know that I'll kind of still have to buy from them because they're the only 2 places I can choose from.
And how do you get these potential students to think about these things? Is it sort of do you do lectures, or is it sort of hands-on modelling or sort of games that you get them to do?
Yeah, so a kind of a mix of all of the above. So we, assuming that at some point social distancing ends, we were going into schools, actually university students into schools. So if anyone listening to this is interested in getting involved, get in touch. We're sending training up university students to go into schools and deliver kind of small classes, giving examples of what economists do. So for example, you could fit into a maths class, and one of the things you would learn in GCSE maths is what a quadratic function is, and that's basically, you know, a line that's increasing but at a decreasing rate. So if that's what you're imagining, you could give that an economic example of that is that you know, happiness is increasing with money, but it doesn't increase at a constant rate. At some point, you kind of, more money doesn't give you that much more happiness. And so that's an example of something that economists also think about. And then you can kind of broaden out to a wider discussion of why that matters, why economists think about it, what that means. I mean, that kind of function tells you that if giving more money to a rich person doesn't add to their happiness as much as giving more money to a poor person, there's a reason where if you're trying to maximize the welfare of everyone in society and you're just trying to add up people's happiness, what you want to do is to take some money away from the slightly richer person and give it to a slightly poorer person, because taking it away from the richer person doesn't cost them a lot of happiness, but giving it to the poorer person gives them much more happiness. So that's one example. Another is that you can go into, say, a business studies lecture where people think about organizational structure and say, okay, well, here's an example of organizational structure. This is borrowed from the CORE syllabus, by the way, for anyone who's used CORE. Organizational structure, think about pirate ships versus Navy ships. Navy ships are very hierarchically organized. The person, the captain of the ship, is paid many, many times what the lowest ranking person on the ship is paid. On a pirate ship, the captain's paid about twice what the lowest rank, you know, what everyone else is essentially paid, or paid in quotes, in terms of the bounty that they get. So what leads to those different structures? Well, think about what the incentives are in a Navy organization versus in a pirate ship type organization. And as we start having a discussion about what the incentives are and what might lead to this, you start realizing, well, what's economics about? It's kind of about incentives. It's about what ways you can use to be able to make the effective choices that people make. That's what economists are thinking about.
Mm-hmm. So really, really rooting it in the real world and those kind of practical examples.
Yeah, and so we do some of that. We have kind of Discover Economics days where school students will come to a university and spend a day with us. And we have kind of fun games as well as a couple of lectures, kind of giving them examples of things economists do. Try to give them a sense for where they can go, talk a bit about what kind of careers economists go on to have and what kind of careers economists could have that we currently don't, but that they could go and do if they wanted to. You know, it might not be what the majority of students currently choose to take in their route out of economics, but there's obviously lots of things. You know, if you do a kind of quantitative social science degree, you have the skills to do all kinds of jobs. You know, currently it's true that a lot of people like to go into, say, accounting or finance or business, but there are many, many other things you could go and do. And so making it clear that you have the skills to and the ability to be employed in these other areas should you want to is also a kind of important part of what we get across. And then we have a kind of a website and a presence online to try to get the message out there sort of more broadly and to create a kind of clearing hub for people to see, you know, what opportunities are out there, when are there going to be other kinds of taster days or internship opportunities and so on, because these are all other useful things that we think it's helpful to provide in the kind of single one-stop shop mm-hmm. type format.
And this is—I mean, this sounds like a full-time job. you're doing this on top of your own research as well. What sort of drives you to take this on and to put this effort into recruiting the next generation from a broader talent pool?
Well, I mean, I think of it as something I care a lot about. I mean, I also care a lot about public policy. Fundamentally, public policy is made economists have a powerful role in public policy. You know, even if you're a person who thinks, well, I don't really like economists, I think that they're not as good as pick your other field, there is a government economic service. There is no government geographic service, government psychological service, government sociological service, or whatever else you feel like kind of should compete with us. So in practice, economists do have a special role in policymaking in this country. They also, you know, obviously are central at the Bank of England. They're also important in all kinds of other organizations. So in practice, economists have now and are going to continue to have an important role in British society. So as long as that's true, it should be important that economists reflect that society and can understand the issues that matter to that society. Mm-hmm. I think that it's not obviously the case right now, but I think that provides a kind of very clear reason why we need to think about who economists are, because they're going to have such an important role in shaping what society looks like in the future.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about your own work on public policy, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on and what challenges you're facing at the moment?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I often talk about kind of all the exciting things economists do and how we think about happiness and how, you know, one of my colleagues kind of went into the files of the Latvian KGB to try and understand the history of that and the incentives there. Other colleagues of mine do kind of all of these cool and crazy things. And then I'm kind of as boring and standard as an economist as you can think about. And yeah, I'll explain to you why I think it's still quite interesting. So I, you know, work basically on tax. So tax, it's hard to get people excited about tax. But working on tax, using tax data from the UK tax authority, I'm able to answer questions like what's actually been happening to inequality in the UK. And if you care about inequality in the UK, what's the best way to look at what's been happening to incomes? Well, it's actually the incomes that people have to report to the government. That's the best tax data. That's the best data you're going to find on what's been going on. And in our work on that, firstly, we've been showing recently that actually the trends in inequality that people have seen previously, actually even just in straightforward income inequality, have been mismeasured because of some of the, some issues around the way the data were being constructed previously. Then the other thing that's nice with the tax data is we typically in the UK have been thinking about inequality, and by inequality here what I mean is in particular will be concentrations of income. So we think about, let's say, the top 1% share. That's the share of all income in the country that goes to the top 1% of people. And then you can think about even smaller groups, like the share that goes to the top 0.1% and so on. But we often think of those measures basing what we're caring about as income. But income, when we define it in those contexts, is typically fiscal income. That is to say, income that is assessable for income tax. But there's a set of people, particularly those towards the top of the distribution, who actually get a lot of the money that they receive in practice, not in the form of taxable income, but in the form of capital gains. So let me give you an example. Suppose that I set up a small company and I, instead of getting paid directly as a, you know, one-man band, getting paid into my bank account and having to declare that for income tax, I get paid into the company and I can pay myself through the company. Now, what I could do is to get, you know, I set up a consultancy and I ask people to pay me money into the consultancy. Then instead of taking that, taking a salary out of that, what I could do is to take dividends. Dividends are taxed at a lower rate. And so I can get a lower rate of tax by, instead of paying myself as income, I can say I get a relatively low income directly, kind of employment income. But what I do get is income in the form of dividend. That's got, that has a lower tax rate. But what I could do even further is not to get paid as dividends, but just to keep money in the company and just leave it, store it in a company bank account for a few years. After a few years, I decide, okay, I'm done. I want to move on to the next thing. I'm going to dissolve my company. That process of dissolving my company, well, I started a company, it was worth nothing. It's now worth whatever it's worth. When I dissolve that company, the gain in value of that company is an asset that I own. I'm the only shareholder of this company. That gain in value is taxed as capital gains. Now, capital gains have a separate tax rate system. The lowest rate is 10%, goes kind of central rate is 20%. So I'm now getting paid either 10 or 20%, depending on whether I qualify for a special kind of relief that gave me the 10% rate. And that's obviously much lower than the rates of income tax that I would have been paying where, you know, on the, if I had a kind of normal-ish income, I'd be paying 20% plus the national insurance contributions of 12%.
Is that partly to reward the risks that you would have taken on in setting up that company, working for yourself as opposed to working for somebody else? Is that part of the logic of this lower tax rate?
It's hard to think about what the logic of the lower tax rate is. I mean, it is a difficult one. But I think that the what we show in our work is that more than half of all of the capital gains that are received are essentially repackaged income. That is to say, it's stuff that would normally look like it's something that should be taxable under the income tax schedule. But what I've done is to move it into a form that gives me a lower tax rate. And so that's clearly not something we want to be covered by that. I think what people imagine when they think about capital gains, they imagine someone who buys a second house, owns it for a while, sells it later on, and the change in value there is a capital gain. I mean, actually, even your own house is buying a house and selling it later as a capital gain, although we give complete relief on the capital gains tax. So there's no capital gains tax on your primary residence. Any further houses that you may at any point have owned, as you buy and sell them, you pay capital gains tax on. And people imagine that that's really kind of a substantial part of, and it's the example people often come up with. People imagine that's a substantial part of capital gains. But it's actually a kind of tiny fraction of all gains are come in that form. And the kind of logic, I guess, one of the logics for charging a different rate on capital gains is one thing you don't necessarily want to tax. So suppose I buy a house and I hold it for 20 years and I sell it and all of the increase in value was just inflation. There was no house, real house price increase. It was just that, you know, inflation over time, the value of the house at the end is a larger number, but it's just an inflation increase. We don't really want to tax people for inflation. That doesn't feel like a good reason. So what we used to have was a system, so in 1988, Nigel Lawson introduced a system where we taxed capital gains at the same rate as income tax, but we had a rate of return allowance that was basically a way, an indexation allowance, which was basically a way to kind of take out that inflationary effect first. But then through a series of reforms, there were kind of a bunch of different changes that were made to it, and eventually it's been now taxed at this much lower rate. And there's no then set kind of separate indexation type allowance. But it's not obvious that this is really kind of solving that problem, because what it's doing in practice, as we've seen, is leading to lots of people using a way of substituting their income where they can into a form where they can get taxed at capital gains tax rates, which are much lower.
And so one of the things you've been highlighting with this research is that potentially a pool of available tax revenues for funding the recovery. Is that right?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a lot of money that's there in principle. So I mean, in one of the pieces of work we did, we just show that, not that this is necessarily what someone's going to do, but if you were to increase the rate of tax on all gains to the same tax rate as headline tax rate. So if you imagine that all of the people who are receiving money in capital gains, instead you treat it as though it were equivalent to income instead, and there were no particular special release on it. If you were to do that, and to do it also for dividends, and to basically remove all release, you get about £20 billion of revenue from doing that, assuming there are no behavioural effects. Now, behavioural effects are obviously important, so you need to also think, if you were going to try and do a direct calculation, you'd need to think about exactly how people would respond to doing this and whether they would, for example, work less or whether they would change some other behaviour they're doing. You also need to kind of take into account the fact that you wouldn't necessarily want to remove all release because there are some release that we think are there for particular reasons. But I think what it highlights is the extent to which there's lots of kind of money out there. That's a kind of, so £20 billion is equivalent to raising, is an amount of money is equivalent to raising the basic rate of income tax from 20% to 24%. You'd get the same amount of cash in a static calculation. So it's sort of, given that we think of raising the basic rate of income tax, or equivalently raising VAT from 20% to 24%. So given we think of those as kind of big, broad changes that would be raising lots of money, although they don't feel like lots of money in this new coronavirus era, there's kind of serious amounts of money there that are available. So at least it means that there's an important case to answer that if you think that reliefs or any of these other things are important and worth preserving, given how much they're costing collectively, it's worth spending some time actually calculating how much money there is kind of that's kind of being spent right now by allowing those things to exist and deciding whether you really think that's worthwhile.
And obviously there would be a very big sort of political issue that is, at the end of the day, it's a political decision, isn't it? Do you see your role as the economist, as the researcher here, but you're doing the analysis and you're saying, look, here's what we've found, over to you guys, you want to raise some money in a fair way, are you sort of informing the politicians, or do you see yourself as having more of an activist role?
There are definitely academics who kind of do a bit more direct campaigning. I mean, I see it as more of a informational role. I mean, ultimately, politicians will make whatever decisions they kind of want to. I think what I'd like to do is to be informing both them and also the public about the choices that we are making and what the implications of those choices are. Ultimately, politicians then have to decide, and the public have to decide, whether they think those are the right choices. Kind of like when we make decisions about what the kind of distribution of income is in the country and what we do to the different income tax rates. I don't think it's, for me particularly, or that I have any special knowledge on, what we ought to do in terms of how high the top rates of income tax should be in any fundamental sense, because that's a political choice. What I can say is, here's what the effects are of making the choices we are making, and here's what would happen if we were to make these alternative decisions. And I think that gives then politicians and the public the information they need to hopefully then kind of weigh those things up, because in some cases we make choices without really knowing we made a choice or what the impact of that choice was. So I think at least understanding that then gives us the kind of information we need to make better choices, mm-hmm. potentially.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of channels are you using to spread the word? You've been to party conference, haven't you? Did you find that as an effective way of raising awareness among politicians?
Yeah, it's certainly true that among academics, I'm, even as one who's not an activist, I am fairly active in trying to communicate the work that I'm doing. Last year, I went to the Labour and Conservative Party conferences to present work I'd been doing on tax audits. So again, it doesn't sound super exciting, but actually what we were working on was trying to understand, there is a certain amount of money, about £35 billion a year of tax revenue that never gets collected. That's about, between 5 and 6% of all of the tax revenue that's owed, and would make it equivalent, if there was kind of a magic button you could press that brought in all of that tax money, it would make it equivalent to sort of the fourth or fifth largest tax in the country. So there's a serious amount of money that's sort of worth spending some time thinking about. Now, obviously, there's lots of different sources from which that money isn't arising, and so you have to think a bit about how you tackle each of those individually. The biggest source of both quantitatively in terms of the amount of cash and also in terms of the amount of behavior, in terms of what share of all money is missing, mm-hmm. that's missing is from self-assessments. That's people who have to fill in the form to say this is what their incomes were. So if you are an employee, you work for one organization, so I work for Warwick, then they pay me, they send me a payslip, and on the payslip it says, here's how much money we didn't pay you because we've already directly transferred it to the government for you. And the government obviously knows, the HMRC knows, that this is how much money, how much tax was paid, offset against my salary. But if instead what I had was kind of a private business, I set up my own organization, some people were paying me directly, I'd have to report to HMRC, this is how much money I got, and this is how much tax I owe you, and I have to send them a check or an electronic check, presumably, of the money I owe. So what we show is that actually, firstly, that there is a substantial amount of non-compliance. So about one in three people who fill this form in are actually underreporting their incomes. But most people, when they are underreporting, it's by relatively small amounts. Mm-hmm. There's actually just a small share of people. So about 6% of the people who are non-compliant, or 2% of the entire self-assessment population, who owe more than half of all of the money that is not paid. Mm-hmm. So it's really the kind of this small slice of people you really want to focus all of your kind of compliance work on to try and make them pay. Then, you know, the most obvious kind of channel that the tax authority has to try to make them pay is to engage in tax audits where effectively they write to them and say, could you tell us, could you confirm to us everything that's on your tax form? And then once you send us kind of paperwork to try and verify that, if we look at it and we can't understand that it exactly lines up with everything we need, maybe we'll come out and talk to you and sit with you and look through your paperwork with you and try and make sure we're kind of happy with everything that you said here. And maybe it turns out there are some things you forgot to declare, or forgot, in quotes. Yeah. I mean, in some cases they are genuine mistakes, but there are lots of cases presumably that aren't. And so what I show is not only do you bring in a lot of money by doing that, but actually in future years, those taxpayers behave better. They pay more money for kind of 5 to 8 years afterwards. And so that means that audits are much more profitable than we previously thought. So I then spent some time kind of talking to people about that. My work was in the newspapers a few times, and I went to party conferences to present this work. And I actually got it into the kind of sights of, with the Conservative government at the moment, got into the sights of the Financial Secretary of the Treasury, and the most recent budget they then passed, in the most recent budget they passed a kind of measure to give more money to the tax authority so they can do more of these kinds of tax audits, because I think basically they've seen that there's kind of solid academic work showing that these are very profitable from a governmental standpoint, and at the same point it's getting money from people who already owed that money and weren't currently paying it, and so that's a kind of relatively easier win. It's sort of hard for any special interest group to stand up and say, oh, we really think it's important that we were not paying our taxes and we should be allowed to continue not paying our taxes. So I think it was a relatively easy win in that way. Mm. I'm a bit surprised it took as long as it took, but it did happen.
But it must still be quite exciting to know that you've shaped a little bit of the rules and legislation that we all live by in a fair way.
Yeah, no, it was definitely very exciting. I was very happy when it happened. and you know, sort of being able to see that the government scores another £4 billion in revenue that's going to come in as a result of my measure. It was definitely very exciting.
No, you weren't able to get a sort of commission on that, were you?
Yeah, I was going to say. I didn't ask. Did the idea and got, you know, 1% of £4 billion would be very nice.
Finder's fee. So that's been really positive for you. You've done the research. You've been able to see that research actually implemented into practice. Is there any sort of top tips you would give to colleagues who are trying to do the same, trying to actually interact with, to try and get themselves heard by decision makers?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. The first is it takes a lot of time, so you have to be sort of willing to engage a significant amount of time that you could otherwise be spending. You have to care about it because you're going to spend time going to these events or talking to people when you could otherwise be doing whatever is your next piece of research and your next idea that you have. And so there is kind of, you know, I said economics is all about trade-offs. There are clear trade-offs here. So if what you value most is just trying to publish another academic paper, then this is not going to be a useful thing to do, because I think some people have the idea, oh, well, I did the research and I sent people the academic paper that I wrote and they didn't read it or they didn't look at enough details of it, so now I'm kind of done. It's not my fault. It does take a lot of time to actually engage with people, and it also does require writing different versions of the work you've done. As long as writing, you know, it feels almost kind of almost pointless, because you're like, oh, I've written that and I'm now writing it again in a slightly different form and now another slightly different form. But, you know, that the example I gave with my work on audits is an academic paper. Then there's a couple of different kind of short form versions, sort of policy brief type objects. Then there's, I wrote a couple of different newspaper articles for it. And I think I've written, I must have written at least one blog post for it. But there's lots of different versions where you're writing essentially the same kind of thing, but for slightly different audiences. And so you need to think about, well, what is this audience interested in and what amount of detail they're going to want and how do I pitch it for them? And that does take a lot of sort of time and it feels almost wasteful and you could spend your time doing the next thing. But if you don't do that, then it's not surprising that people aren't going to pick it up. They also are busy. They also have trade-offs. And for them, you know, the idea of diving into a 50-page academic paper with long appendices to try and figure out what the policy idea is, it's just not very appealing. So you do need to spend the time doing that and then giving presentations to them and then them realizing that what they wanted to do was actually put you in touch with one of their colleagues who's more interested in the fact you do something. And you give a presentation to them and then they pass you on again. It is really an investment. So you have to, you do have to care.
Yeah. And so time consuming when there are many other demands on the work that you are doing. What's the next mountain ahead? What are you working on that's at early stages?
Well, the current big mountain is a project I'm running with Andy Summers at the LSE and Emma Chamberlain, who's a barrister, on whether or not the UK should have a wealth tax. So we're genuinely very open to this, either way. A wealth tax would be a tax that says some percentage of all assets or some subset of assets would be paid every year to the government. And there's lots of issues. First is, like, you know, economically, is there even a sensible way to design the tax? And then there's lots of practical things of, you know, if you thought this was a good idea, if you thought the public were behind it, so we've got some work that Ipsos Mori and an academic from Birmingham are doing, looking at the kind of public attitudes of it, then what are all the kind of practical things, like how would you value all of the assets? I mean, presumably you wouldn't revalue everything completely every year, but what would you do in practice to do that? What do you do about enforcement mechanisms? What do you do about the fact that there'll be people who have large amounts of wealth but relatively low incomes, so the kind of proverbial granny and, you know, granny widow who has a big house but has no longer got much of an income. What do you do about her? And how many of those kind of people are there? There's a whole load of issues to think about. So I think it's both not obvious that in theory it's a good idea, and it's not obvious that in practice it's possible. But there are reasons. There's a lot of people who have been interested in it and have been thinking about it for a while now in terms of promoting it, particularly in the US. There was this, when Elizabeth Warren was running for the president, a couple of academics had written a proposal for her for how a wealth tax could be structured. At the other extreme, you know, Switzerland has a wealth tax, but rather than it being focused on the billionaires, everyone pays it on assets above 100,000, roughly 100,000 euros. So there are very different ways of designing a wealth tax. It doesn't have to be a soak the rich type of structure at all. And certainly if we come down thinking that a wealth tax is possible, we will be thinking about, well, what are the limits to a wealth tax? But we'll also not intend to say, if it is a good idea, that it should be applied at this particular rate and only on the super rich or anything like that, or that it should be applied on everyone. I think our goal, as I said earlier, I think of sort of politicians make those kinds of choices. For us, it's more like thinking, what's the space of things that are possible and reasonable? So it might be that we say, well, look, you can't have a wealth tax that starts at only £20,000 because there's too many people who are covered by it and it's too complicated to value all of those assets, the amount of money you would get from it. It would only make sense to start at some higher threshold. And that's the kind of thing we might say if that's what we find in, when we're trying to do the design work for it. But I think for us, it's ultimately about trying to work out, in principle, is it of interest? How could it work? What would the issues be? And then to kind of deliver that again for politicians to then think about what they want to do with it in practice.
Mm-hmm. Great. And very timely with, you know, there are some big questions being asked now, aren't there, about how to fund the recovery. And so perhaps there'll be an open door, an open ear, perhaps, at the Treasury to hear those conclusions.
Yeah, I certainly think it's the sort of, it's a time in which people are starting to have these big ideas on tax and to try and think, well, what is going to be the solution? Right now, I think they haven't figured out how to pay for any of the additional spending that's been required around coronavirus, and it's probably the right decision, not the time to start thinking about raising taxes when we're in a bit of an economic crisis. But ultimately, we are going to have to start thinking about that if we're going to pay for the better public services and the levelling up and building back better that various politicians have been talking about. All of those things do require more cash at some point. And so then thinking, well, what does that extra money look like and where are you thinking about getting it from? Are you thinking that it's going to be, you know, raising, say, VAT or basic rate of income tax or higher rates of income tax? Those are kind of the classic options that people sort of come to normally. But I think there's a bit of a recognition that firstly, I mean, the Conservative government originally, when it had its manifesto, had ruled those things out. obviously I'm not sure that anyone would feel like they needed to hold them to that manifesto in the current crisis that I think wasn't particularly on anyone's mind at the time that manifesto was written. But I think they are open to thinking out alternative choices and focusing on other things that haven't necessarily taken as much, haven't had as much attention previously.
Mm. Great. No, thank you. I think that's just really interesting, and it's a real example of sort of where we came in of economics being that discipline that provides the details and addresses the questions and really helps people understand what choices are going to be ahead of us.
I should say, by the way, that the it's part of that economics at the same time as being the place that can make those decisions, and that economists don't and shouldn't work alone. So my co-authors are both lawyers. On the project overall, we have people who are in social policy, who are in law, who are in accountancy, who are in public attitudes, economists, of course. There's a kind of broad range of people who are involved in this project, because the only way you can, in practice, deliver these kind of political things. I think that is one of the risks sometimes, is that economists can come up with, like, here's an economically beautiful, most sensible idea, without then also interacting with people in these other spaces who also have their own kind of points to make. For example, I mean, one of the things that economists are not always great at doing, at least academically, is thinking about, well, fine, this works sort of ideally in principle, but what about all of the administrative hurdles that come from implementing in practice? And those administrative hurdles create real costs. That means that, for example, you couldn't, I think genuinely, you couldn't think about having a wealth tax that started at, say, £5,000, because clearly there are way too many people who have assets above £5,000. The administrative hurdles would be far too large. And I think that's so obvious that I don't think anyone needs to be told it. But there are all kinds of other administrative hurdles that exist. And so even if you look further up for a wealth tax, or if you're thinking about some other tax reform, sometimes those things aren't fully considered, and those are important to take into account when you're trying to design public policy.
Mm-hmm. Great. Lovely. And if I'm going to put you on the spot with one final question, if you were doing the interviewing, who would you want to have in the hot seat? Is there an economist, living or dead, that you would like, you would want to be talking to about their work or about what their approach?
Ooh, now that's a good question. So not at all in my field, but I think I would probably go for Frank Ramsey. So he was an economist at Cambridge, and he died in his early 20s. So it's, he basically wrote two papers that are tax-related, that are theory more theoretical, but that are kind of major advances in thinking about the way that we should kind of... So one was on thinking... One paper was on optimal growth. The other paper was thinking about how do you design taxes under a particular constraint. He's basically thinking about what's the right way to change prices for different kinds of goods if you're trying to raise money while minimizing the substitution effects that are created by by distorting prices. And so these are two kind of very amazing papers that do kind of fantastic. It's, having said that economists don't have to be math, these are very mathematical papers, but they're both very beautiful. And I always wonder, given how young he died, what he would have done. He died at the age that most of our undergraduates are just about graduating, and he's written these two papers that are so fantastic. So I do wonder what would have happened if he'd had another 50 years of career. And I'd be interested to know what else he would have been thinking and what else he would have been working on.
Where his work might have gone. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. This has been really interesting, and it's been fascinating. Thank you very much for making time.
You have been listening to Warwick Econ Sounds, a podcast series from the Department of Economics at Warwick University. Please follow the links on our website for further information about Dr. Advani's work and the Discover Economics campaign.